Hello and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this Word Magazine, I am pleased to have a guest who is going to join me by audio, and I'm going to be interviewing him. My guest is going to be Dr. Crawford Gribben, and he is the author of a new book from Oxford University Press, came out in 2021. The book is titled Survival and Resistance in Evangelical America, subtitled Christian Reconstruction in the Pacific Northwest. And we're going to be discussing this book. And I just finished reading it, and it's an intriguing topic. It caught my interest when I saw the title. And I got in touch with Dr. Gribben, and he agreed to join me to have an interview. So Dr. Gribben, we can't see you, but we've got you here by audio. Welcome to Word Magazine. Glad to have you as a guest today.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be here. You're actually seeing my best profile as I'm sitting in the dark. But it's great. It's great to meet you. Appreciate your work. And as you know, I think really highly of the book you did on John Owen and Scripture. It's been a huge help. And thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And I appreciate those who don't know, I sent the introductory essay to you for that book, and you read it and gave me some feedback on it. I appreciate you doing that. So before we discuss your book, and I got to apologize to people who are listening. I'm having a little issue with my throat. Hopefully you can hear me clearly enough. But before we get started talking about your book, if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? Where do you teach? Tell us a little bit about yourself, Dr. Gribben, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, I think if people are struggling to listen to you, they might really struggle to understand what I'm saying. So perhaps you should speak very slowly. My name's Crawford Gribben, as you mentioned before. I grew up in Scotland, but actually my parents were from Northern Ireland, which is where I currently live. I teach in Belfast. There's the university there, Queen's University Belfast. I teach history. I've done lots of other things over the years, but that's what I'm doing at the moment. And it's fine. It's good. It's nice. Good fun. I go to church in a town called Ballymena, which is one of the bigger towns outside Belfast. And it's an evangelical church, and really glad to be there and to enjoy the fellowship with the Christians who meet there too.
Great, great. I wonder, how has COVID affected your church's meeting over there? Have you guys been able to meet?
No, we haven't been allowed to meet, not since Boxing Day, the day after Christmas. We've been in complete lockdown. I've lost count now of the number of weeks we've been in lockdown over the last 12 months or so. So we were told we were going to have a 6-week lockdown beginning on Boxing Day, but that's actually just lifting this weekend. So I suppose there's big pressure from some of the bigger denominations where I live that they want people to be back in the building for Easter. Last Easter, if you celebrate Easter, last Easter was, I think, the first Easter probably since Christianity came to Ireland where the churches were closed. And I think people really understood the significance of that. It's been tricky. We have done various things on Lord's Days. We most recently have been allowed to have a small number of people in the building where we meet. And so the preaching is done live. There's a small singing group who lead us through, you know, various songs and hymns and so on. And everyone then sits at home and participates live with that small group. But this coming Sunday, all being well, we should be together in the building. So that's something to look forward to.
I'm glad you guys are going to be able to be back together. So you are a historian, and you teach history at the Queen's University. So what are your areas of interest? In teaching and writing? I know you've written quite a bit about John Owen and about the Puritans.
Yeah.
But what are your areas of interest in scholarship and in writing?
Well, I did my PhD back in the 1990s at University of Strathclyde in Glasgow. And from a PhD, I was interested in thinking about Puritan millennialism. So by way of background, I'd grown up in the Plymouth Brethren in the west of Scotland. And if any listeners know about the Plymouth Brethren, they'll know that they're strongly dispensational. Or rather, they tend to be strongly dispensational. Our church wasn't as strong as lots of others were. But they tend to have a real interest in thinking about the coming again of Jesus Christ, which, you know, all Christians ought to. But I'd also discovered A.W. Pink, Martin Lloyd-Jones, and all of these writers via the Banner of Truth. And so I was interested then in thinking, well, what might be a different way of thinking about the end times? And so a local Free Church of Scotland minister, Maurice Roberts, had encouraged me to begin reading some more serious works in Reformed theology. And as I did that, I began to take an interest in Puritanism. And then thinking about how Puritans thought about the end of the world gave me, I suppose, two big research areas that I've continued to be interested in. One of those, as you intimated just now, is Puritanism. And within Puritanism, I've become particularly interested in John Owen, as you know, as you are, Jeff, as well. And secondly, then, the other thing that I've continued to be interested in is the long history of apocalyptic thought, and particularly millennial thought. And so I've done various things over the years that I've tried to plug in projects that try to elucidate how the way we have thought about the end times has changed within broadly evangelical, Puritan / evangelical circles. So I did a book maybe about 2011 called Evangelical Millennialism in the Transatlantic World from 1500 to 2000. So that tried to present the big sweep. And then I've done other projects that look at particular areas. So I did, I'm currently writing about Darby, who's the kind of inventor of dispensationalism. I did a book a couple of years ago on the Left Behind novels, which some listeners might be aware of as a very popular expression of rapture, tribulation, millennium, that kind of paradigm. And then the book that we're talking about today is, I suppose, the most up-to-date, the most current of all of these examples of millennial thinking, because it's about groups of Christians who are often moving into the Pacific Northwest, often, though not always, strongly post-millennial in the way that they think about the end times, or actually just about the future, not just about the end times. And so, you know, that's what I've been interested in. So Puritanism, and then also the long history of apocalyptic or millennial thought.
I think it's interesting the way that you've been able to looking at the span of what you've written about, like you said, writing about, you know, apocalyptic thought or millennial thinking historically in some of the Puritans and others, and then sort of applying in a contemporary, like the work you've done on I guess eschatological fiction, sure. That's Left Behind books, and definitely this book, your new book, seems to fit that, like you said, and it's sort of a contemporary reflection on how millennial or post-millennial thought is influencing a certain segment of evangelical Christianity in survival and resistance in evangelical America. So how was it that you came to want to write this book? What sparked your interest in wanting to study what's happening in contemporary Pacific Northwest USA?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Jeff. Well, back in the mid-90s, when I was doing my postgrad studies, I would often go across to Edinburgh. And in Edinburgh, the capital city of Scotland, in Edinburgh, there used to be a brilliant Reformed theological bookshop called James Dixon Books. And it was great. You could go downstairs, you know, and I'm sure you love secondhand bookshops as much as I do. You can lose a lot of time and indeed money in those locations. But one of the things that I picked up in James Dixon Books was actually something I got for free. And I literally almost tripped over in their secondhand section. I literally almost tripped over this pile of magazines that were sitting on the floor. Now, I then bent down to look at them. And these were issues of a magazine called Credenda Agenda, which is, at that point, was a magazine that was being distributed from Moscow, Idaho, by a church called Community Evangelical Fellowship that was pastored by a man called Douglas Wilson, who at that time was not known nearly as much as he has become since. So there was a whole raft of these magazines, I don't know, maybe 20 different issues. and they very kindly said they're there for the taking. So I took them and began reading them and reading them very carefully and thinking about them. And of course, all of this at the same time as I was writing a thesis about Puritan postmillennialism, I was beginning to see a contemporary expression of postmillennialism, which was really quite new to me. You know, I'd never really come across this before. So I began to pay attention to this group, especially to Doug Wilson's writing. It was sharp, it was polemical, it was witty, it was often satirical, it was erudite, it was well-informed, it was controversial. I mean, it was all of those things. It made for very good reading, quite apart from anything else. His little book on pedobaptism to 1,000 generations is probably, I thought, the best defense of pedobaptism I ever read. A very insightful and careful account of how you might construct a doctrine of baptism. I didn't find it in the end convincing, but I certainly found it impressive in lots of ways. So it's really from the 1990s, and I was watching this group, following their publications, reading Doug's books, Nancy Wilson's books as they came out, and just generally being aware that there was something quite interesting happening there. Doug Wilson and Gary DeMar, who I began reading at the same time, another theonomist writer, sent me back to R.J. Rushdoony. So I began collecting R.J. Rushdoony, Gary North books, reading them, talking about them with some of my friends at the time as well. There's never been much of a Reconstructionist movement in Northern Ireland, but our religious and political culture would be very susceptible to that way of approaching things. In that our political culture is often very dominated by religious voices that almost want to, that do want to have maximum Christian influence in society. They don't always argue the case successfully or even in a very attractive way. But that is there. So reading all of that was one part of it. Then around about 2007, 2008, there was, of course, the global financial crash. And I began getting interested in what people online were talking about survivalism. Now, I wasn't a survivalist. I'm not a survivalist. I can't afford to be a survivalist. But I was kind of curious about what they were doing. And there was I discovered a really big survivalist website called survivalblog.com, led by a man who would identify as a Reformed Baptist, a man called James Wesley Rawls, based in an unknown location somewhere east of the Rockies. Which is, quite a big territory. But James Wesley Rawls began to publish novels as well. And some of these novels, his novels are explicitly Christian. They promote survivalism. They promote techniques for survival, for preparation of various kinds. Very strongly recommending an evangelical Christian faith. Very strong in the King James Version of the Bible, for example. So there's lots of things swirling around there. But what really caught my attention was when these two different worlds began to collide, because some of the characters in James Wesley Rawls' novels actually end up going to Doug Wilson's church in Moscow, Idaho. And then I began to understand that there was much more going on in these two different worlds than I had really given credit for, that they were, in a way, overlapping circles. James Wesley Rawls' website has got a list of churches that he's encouraging people to move to, because he's encouraging people to move into this part of the Pacific Northwest, the area mainly in Idaho and Montana, but the surrounding states as well, an area that he calls the American Redoubt or the American Redou, if you're French. But so I began to see how these things were crossing over into one another. And then the third thing, I suppose, that really prompted the interest to become a project was that I was working with a guy in Dublin at that point who was from Coeur d'Alene, and we were and remain good friends, great friends, and we just planned a road trip, Jeff. So to just, two academics justifying a road trip, it's got to be a research project if you're going to get grant money for it. So that's what we tried to do. And we had a great time, went across first of all in 2015, went back in 2016. By that stage, I had been doing some long distance interviews. I suppose it began speaking to James Wesley Rawls by telephone back in 2013. And then going in 2015, 2016, and then staying in touch and conducting some interviews in the aftermath of that as well. And then it all came together, hopefully, convincingly, in the book that we're talking about today, Survival and Resistance in Evangelical America, Christian Reconstruction in the Pacific Northwest.
So you gathered information by reading about it, then you went and did in-person interviews with It's interesting, as I was sort of reading this, I was thinking, I know you're a historian, but there's almost kind of an you're almost like an anthropologist also.
That's a bad word, Jeff.
That's a bad word.
Yeah. Well, I work with anthropologists at Queen's. In fact, an anthropologist and I teach one of our classes together. So since I came to Queen's, I have got a little bit more interest in anthropology, at least to be able to spell it now, which wasn't always the case. But it's fascinating. And I suppose that the insight you get from combining history with anthropology is that within history, you explore the ideas as they're published. But the added dimension anthropology brings is that you then go to visit the people whose work you've been reading, and you get to see whether their lived reality corresponds to the words they publish or not. And so, you know, once you contextualize the words they publish in the lives that they lead, in the communities they participate in the churches they attend or sometimes don't attend, I think then it sort of opens up and broadens out the meaning of those words. And you begin to see not only confirmations of the printed word, but also contradictions of the printed word. So, for example, in Coeur d'Alene, one of the groups that we spent time with was a kinist group. So these are, they would say they're not racial, they're not white. So how would they say? They would say they're not racist, they're racialists. So they don't believe in the supremacy of one race above another, but the distinction between races. I think that's how they would put it. So, you know, spent time with them. They're very much influenced by all of the ideas that we're talking about today, but they add this kind of racial twist to it as well. And, you know, speaking to them, they seem very coherent, very smart, very thoughtful and sacrificial in the way that they were approaching their living out their convictions. So that was how the conversation went. But then when we began to look at the broader lived reality, it turned out one of them was also attending a mixed race congregation, a very ordinary congregation. So, you know, it's helpful then to cross-check the published ideas with the lived reality, because then you begin to realize quite a lot of this is just rhetoric and opinion, and it's not necessarily lived out in a consistent way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That's interesting. And I remember you making that point in the book when you were talking about some of your interactions with people that are in the Kinist movement. Yeah. So just before we get much further, what is happening as you perceive it in the Pacific Northwest? What you talk in the book about there being a migration, you know, to the Pacific Northwest, and in particular to the panhandle of Idaho, and
that's right,
and to Eastern Washington, and
that's right, Western Montana. Yeah, exactly.
What's going on out there?
Well, obviously, this is a part of the world that people that people have often migrated to, been migrating to this area for a long, long time, and this migration seems to have picked up really in the last 30 years. Almost everybody I spoke to in Idaho in particular had come from California. So, you know, lots of these people were just kind of ordinary, regular people who didn't see themselves as migrants, but for one reason or another, whether it's jobs or opportunities or cheaper property or you know, reduced taxes, at some point they had moved their family or themselves into this area to live. So I'm not talking about the general movement into this area. I'm talking about a very particular kind of migration, which is a migration of political and religious conservatives from California, of course, but from lots of other states and even beyond the United States, even from Europe, into this part of North America, to take part in a very particularly conceived vision of preparing for a short-term catastrophe in American culture and being ready to rebuild something on the other side of that catastrophe. So It's very difficult, Jeff, to give exact numbers to participants in this migration for obvious reasons. Some of them are too, Second Amendment enthusiasts. They don't especially want to draw attention to why they might be moving to that area or what they might be doing when they are there. So it's hard to get exact numbers. But one person who we thought was pretty well placed to make an estimate, estimated from the basis of his church's quite explosive growth, grown up to 800 people, he reckoned about maybe 10,000 people had migrated by that point. That was back in 2015. Now, subsequently to 2015, our hunch that there was a migration happening was confirmed by an article in The Economist magazine, in their Christmas special, I think 2016 or 2017, 2016 it might have been, and also by other press coverage in the Washington Post of all places, which and these journalists who were writing these articles were recognizing that something that was very hard to identify was happening in Idaho because house prices were shooting up. And shooting up in some of the most unlikely places, some of the most out of the way, obscure, hard to find places. And why was this happening? Well, The Economist magazine in particular understood that there were in fact a number of real estate agents who were selling property that they were advertising as defensible property. So these weren't people who were maybe retirees out of the LAPD just looking for a quieter life. These were people who were moving to Idaho with a very particular kind of agenda. It wasn't just people who are moving up for an IT job in Moscow, Idaho. It was also people who are moving out to St. Maries, Idaho, or in the area around Sandpoint or around Hayden Lake or out to Spokane or across the Kalispell. There was something much, much more significant going on than that. And it was to do, as far as we could work out, it was to do with the migration of political and religious conservatives to an area that was identified by James Wesley Rawls on his blog, survivalblog.com, as the American redoubt, the last holdout for American freedoms. This would be where it would be. And of course, many people are moving into this area following Rawls's call, are also paying attention to the kinds of churches he's recommending on his website and in his novels. And some of them are ending up in places like Moscow, Idaho, where they move from, I don't know, a small discouraged congregation in a largely democratic stronghold, let's say, in one of the seaboard states. And they move to Moscow, Idaho. And yes, Moscow, Idaho is a kind of a blue dot in a red sea. But right within the middle of that blue dot, they discover a very rich and energetic and creative Christian community that sustains not only its own liberal arts college and school, but also a music conservatory, multiple congregations, and has, quite considerable cultural reach from this tiny, rather obscure town in the Palouse, selling books through major presses, major commercial presses, not Christian, but commercial presses. And even hosting talk shows on Amazon Prime. So, this is not the kind of survivalism that we're prepped, if you can use that word, to expect. It's an expectation of short-term tribulation with long-term success that's actually not an isolating, but a very engaging, often very impressive kind of experience that I think people are being invited into.
Well, you were talking about, let's say, I mean, I live here in Virginia, and when I first moved to Virginia, more than 20 years ago, this state was a reliable red state, and over the course of time, it sort of changed, and now it's kind of become a blue state. And I've talked with some of my fellow, conservative Christians in the state. And, there is kind of a sense of frustration. I wish we could be someplace where our values were reflected in the government, and you know what I mean? And I can see why people in frustration might think, I'll relocate to someplace where, people who think like me are the dominant members of the population. And I know there wasn't there was an effort among some conservatives at one point to try to move like to South Carolina.
That's right. Christian Exodus, wasn't it?
Right. And so maybe, you know, this same sort of phenomenon, you know, happening with people trying to go to the Pacific Northwest. You mentioned, though, Doug Wilson and Moscow, and now it's called Christ Church, right, in Moscow.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And you mentioned he is a religious entrepreneur, whether that's, education materials, founding Canon Press. And I didn't realize until I read your book that he is now has a Amazon Prime show that he writes, I guess, or produces.
He's the host of it. Yeah, it's a talk show. He hosts it. Yeah.
Okay. So I don't have Amazon Prime, so I haven't seen that. But you take this, you see Doug Wilson as a sort of contemporary representative or an outgrowth from the Christian Reconstructionist movement. And you called it the subtitle of your book is Christian Reconstruction in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
So you had the phenomenon of among in reform circles of a Christian reconstruction theology with Rush Dooney and Gary North and others. How do you see Doug Wilson being sort of in that line?
Well, that's a good question, Jeff. And it is something that people ask. But I think when you look at Doug's writing, whether it's online or printed writing, whether it's within the last year or two, even the last week or two, in fact, even this week, he's posted something on his blog that cites Rush Dooney. But whether you look at his up-to-date writing or indeed his writing back from the earliest issues of Credenda Agenda in the late 80s, early 1990s, he has always been interested in Rush Dooney. And I think he has a real respect for Rush Dooney. In one blog post, I forget how long ago he did it, he lists the writers who have most affected him in terms of style and ideas, and Rush Dooney's included in that list. It's a very eclectic list, I'll admit that, but Rush Dooney is there. Rush Dooney really matters for him. He's, I think, probably less appreciative of the work of someone like Gary North, for example. But I think Doug Wilson looks at Rush Dooney and sees someone who is trying to think in very unpropitious circumstances, trying to think, what would someone like Cornelius Van Til make of American society in the 1960s? And what Rush Dooney does in his earliest publications is take some of those key presuppositional ideas and tools to try to work out the future direction of American society. And Rush Dooney gets very bad press sometimes. That's not necessarily always wrong. Rush Dooney does often get a bad press, but Rush Dooney, I think, of all American evangelical leaders in that period, is the most prophetic. Because he is able to see that what's going to happen in the 70s, 80s, 90s and beyond is that his society is going to change by becoming more consistent with its own presuppositions. So he would look at American society in the 60s and say, 20 years from now, and by and large, his prognostications were Rush Dooney's thought, and see that Rush Dooney was a genuine cultural critic. He was engaged with the direction of society. Rush Dooney had quite, by comparison to that crisis that he anticipated. Doug Wilson's approach to the crisis is much more multifaceted. Rush Dooney was emphasized, I think it's fair to say, someone might correct me, I think it's fair to say Rush Dooney would emphasize family above church. But Doug Wilson wants to keep family and church together, but he also wants to build community and society around that. So while Rushdoony and the early Reconstructionist Sky North among them would emphasise the value of church life and dismiss, for example, Olson would want to say, actually, we need to recover, as Dorothy Sayers would put it, the lost tools of learning, to give people as broad and liberal an education as be fruitful, rooted, but much more hostile before it ever comes out of that to become something good again. So I think Doug Wilson would recognise that he's drawing on Rushdoony. He does so critically, that's for sure. But I think that's where he's getting his big agenda from. I think that Doug Wilson is then stepping back from that and saying we need to do something much broader than the first two generations of Reconstructionists ever did. And I think that it's also true to say that Doug Wilson is much more successful than the earlier exponents of Reconstruction, because he has been able not only to build a church, he planted that church, he's seen it grow, he's seen people move to it, but that church has spawned a printing press, Canon Press, a school, Logos Christian School, from 1994, I think, into the UK, hundreds of members of schools in it, so a musical conservatory, and, you know, missionary interest now stretching across the world. So Rushdoony was probably more of a theorist than a doer. I think Doug Wilson, as you said before, has got a bit more of the entrepreneur about him and is determined to make ideas work. And I think, you know, whatever people feel about him, I think he has done that very, very successfully.
Right. Your audio is coming through a little choppy at times, but I'm hopefully we'll be able to record it. But I was just thinking about how the very last page of your book, on page 149, you say, perhaps in the person of Rushdoony, the evangelical Saint Benedict had already arrived. And we'll talk about in a moment about the Rod Dreher and the Benedict option, but this idea of Christians needing to survive in an increasingly secular society. And you do seem to sort of say in the book, you know, you had the Reconstructionist movement, theological movement, which sort of seemed to have died out. And then maybe somebody like Doug Wilson has sort of extended it in new and creative ways, providing a kind of a Protestant way for Christians to both withdraw from society, but also be influential in society, if that makes sense. But maybe we'll get back to that comment in a second. So other than in the book, you've already talked about John Wesley Rawls as a writer and a fiction writer and a survivalist, and Doug Wilson as a churchman and a thinker and an entrepreneur, how they've sort of had an influence in the so-called survival and resistance movement. Is there anybody else you think that's been significant in this beyond those two fellows?
I think Jeff, they are probably the two most significant figures. James Wesley Rawls speaking to this much more militia orientated perhaps militia is not the right word, but militaristically orientated survivalists, but speaking to them as a Christian and speaking to them as someone who wants to promote the gospel within that circle. And I think then Doug Wilson is the sort of main street guy, you know, the guy who is the guy you see walking down the main street. So I think they are the two most significant figures. There's lots of other people out there as well. You know, there's a huge number of different kinds of people involved in this movement. Some of them much happier to identify themselves with it than others. I was in touch with one pastor of a congregation, a Presbyterian congregation that had moved en masse from upstate New York to Idaho. Sometimes we think about congregational emigration as something that happened in the 17th century, but there's an example of it happening in our own day. So it's not just individuals, not just families. There are even entire congregations prepared to up sticks and move together to live together as a Christian community in that part of the world. So lots of different voices online. There's a huge range of voices. But I think James Wesley Rawls and Doug Wilson are really the representing the two biggest constituencies that I think are part of this movement.
You were there in 2015 doing your field research and interviews and so forth.
Yeah.
And that was, and then you said in 2016 also. And so that was right at the time when Trump, you know, unexpectedly won the presidential election. Of the people who were there, you know, sort of building the American redoubt, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, what was the reaction to Trump being elected? And then what do you think the reaction has been after his defeat in 2020 is with respect to people's sense about the place of conservative Christians in American society and what the future holds?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Jeff. I was there, as you said, for the first time in summer 2015. So that was just in the run-up to the November election, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And at that point, nobody that I spoke to, I think one person of all the people that I spoke to, only one person was prepared to say they were going to vote for Trump. Mm. So there was no groundswell of support for Trump. I think in 2015, the Moscow Idaho Christians were still very much in the mentality about politics that they had been developing for the previous, 20 plus years, which is to say that they did not want to identify with a candidate or even necessarily with a party, that their preference was instead to step out from binary politics of red and blue or left and right, and to recognize that both those political options, as they were being presented to them in the form of national politics, both of those options were actually anti-Christian.
Hmm.
So I mean, some of the articles in Credenda Agenda, Bush Gore, various elections, made the same point repeatedly, that the left and the right did not disagree in the destination of society, only the speed at which they would arrive there. Hmm. So you could say that was the kind of a deep-seated cynicism about politics. It also reflected their optimism that they didn't need politics to achieve the goals that they had, the spiritual goals that they had. So I think one of the refrains that you see in that writing is that there are no political solutions to spiritual problems.
Hmm.
And I think to their credit, they didn't want to be necessarily identified with one group or another group when the only solutions those groups could offer were purely pragmatic, political, social, cultural solutions. So, you know, I remember asking one staff member at New St. Andrews, what's the big agenda? And he said, well, the big agenda is really simple. We preach the Bible and see what happens next.
Hmm.
Now, you know, from a Christian perspective, that's there's an appealing simplicity to that. So that was 2015. 2016 was slightly different. But 2020 was different again, because by 2020, obviously, a lot had changed from 2015 in the cultural condition of the United States. And I think quite a number of the people I was speaking to had moved away from their hesitation about Trump, actually to see Trump as someone who could in fact save them.
Hmm.
So I didn't get to write about that in the book, because the book went to press actually, well, the book was finalized in the summer 2019. So I didn't get to write about all of this in the book. But I think the 2020 election did change this community in a way. And you might remember back in, was it December or January, I forget which, President Trump actually retweeted a video of a Sam Singh of the Moscow, Idaho Christchurch congregation outside the Moscow, Idaho town hall, where the police were coming and arresting people because they were gathering in defiance of COVID regulations. And I think it was kind of an irony that Trump made that retweet, because he probably didn't realize it, but this was a community that had always been hostile to him, except probably for the previous, well, hostile is maybe too strong word, but critical of him until probably just the previous few months to when he retweeted them. So, you know, I suppose it was one of those episodes during that election related to religious politics that I suppose reminded us that, you know, there's a lot at stake here. And I think even principled apolitical actors like the Moscow Idaho Christians still found themselves being drawn into the national politics they had spent 20 years critiquing.
Hmm. These are strange times, I think, you know, for Christians in the U.S. and in Canada. I mean, we're hearing about, you know, things that are happening in Canada with pastors being arrested, like Pastor Coates in Alberta, and, you know, churches being fined. And, you know, I think the COVID restrictions have tested, you know, where are the lines for religious freedom? Where are the lines for individual liberties and freedoms? And, you know, I saw a stat just this week that said, I think for the first time, for the first time, at least in a long time, that less than 50% of the U.S. population identified as belonging to a church. The U.S. has been a country influenced by Christianity, and if not part of a vital spirituality in individual lives, at least it's sort of, there's a veneer of it within the society, at least. But there does seem to be a lot of change going on, and I noted in the introduction to your book, the very first line is American religion is changing. And then later on in the opening chapter, you wrote, perhaps the future of American evangelicalism may be best observed on its margins. So thinking about those two quotations from your book, how is American religion changing? And what do you see in the margins, maybe in some of these groups in the Pacific Northwest? What do you see that is a bellwether for how American religion is changing?
That's a really interesting question, Jeff. I suppose I would say that religion in America, just like religion in any other country, is always changing. You know, it's never static. There are always new things happening, good or bad. There's always some kind of change afoot. But I suppose what I'm getting at there is that American religion is changing in very specific ways and in response to very specific cultural pressures. So recently a pollster ran a book or published a book called The End of White Christian America. And this is a book that I used a lot when I was thinking through some of the issues that the research was throwing up. So, you know, this idea of the end of white Christian America, well, first of all, whenever he unpacks that idea, he is talking a lot about race, that for the first time, white Americans are going to find themselves as a minority. But the second thing that he's talking about is that alongside that kind of shift, there's another shift happening, which is a shift not in terms of race or pigmentation in skin color, but a shift in terms of cultural attitudes that are being expressed within some of these communities. So in his analysis, he does lots of sampling to show what beliefs among younger evangelicals are about issues to do with, you know, some of the hot button social issues of the day, abortion and other kinds of issues. And he's discovering that the younger generation of evangelicals, self-described, I know it's a problematic category, but the number of the younger generations of evangelicals are much, much, much less consistent theologically than their parents' generation have been. So there is this erosion of foundations within evangelicalism, even within conservative evangelicalism. And of course, in the States, there's lots and lots of examples of how this has been worked out over the last number of months, even the last couple of years, in terms of thinking about critical theory and you know, and all of these other issues that are being discussed. So I think that's what's happening very much on at the center of American evangelicalism. But on the periphery of American evangelicalism and some of these smaller groups, like the Reformed Baptists, for example, you have someone like James White, beginning to promote, I don't know exactly what you would call it, but some form of theonomy, maybe a kind of a soft form of theonomy. I'm not quite sure how you put it, but I think he's very much taking his cue from some of the developments that are happening in the region that the book is talking about in North Idaho. So I think you've got two things there. You've got the kind of softening up of the center of evangelicalism, which has been happening for a long time, but it's now reaching a tipping point, I think. And then on some of the margins of evangelicalism, you've got this kind of hardening, or rather a gathering around a much, 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 much more robust political, or not political, but a much more robust cultural view that is intent on addressing some of these changes within American evangelicalism in a very, very robust way. So I think those are some of the ways it's been changing as I see it. Jeff, others may see it differently. But I think that what you have then in North Idaho and in these quote-unquote survivalist type situations is actually a window as to what the future of American evangelicalism is going to look like. I think that it's going to be much, much more conscious of its minority status, much, much, much more focused on churchliness, if you like, rather than cultural engagement, and much, much more focused on evangelism as the way by which America will be changed. So I think that as evangelicalism changes, conservative evangelicals will probably diminish in size, and the political expressions of evangelicalism will be much less interesting for conservative evangelicals to consider. So what will they do as that happens? I think they'll have to think really carefully about whether the world of politics is something that offers them anything at all. And if they decide it doesn't, then they'll be forced back to thinking about, well, actually, what do we need? What do we mean when we pray thy kingdom come? Are we actually praying for a political solution to a spiritual problem? Right. Or are we having to begin to recognize that the only tools of our warfare are the spiritual tools that Paul speaks about in his letter to Corinth?
It's interesting, and I'm here in Central Virginia, and just down the road, you know, an hour from where I am is Lynchburg, Virginia. And you think about Jerry Falwell, you know, having been there and, you know, started Liberty University, but of course he started the Moral Majority, you know. Yeah. And, you know, had that influence in the 1970s and getting Reagan elected. But then you look back on that and what did that really accomplish?
So
I think a lot of conservative evangelicals sort of feel like, well, the Republican Party isn't much different than the Democratic Party. What profit was gained for conservative or evangelical Christians? And then what are the alternatives? How do we live in the world but not of it? How can we live faithful Christian lives, and how can our churches be faithful churches? And how can we be salt and light without being corrupted by trying to control and have influence in government?
Well,
Baptist in saying that, maybe I'm more of a quietist, just wanting to not be involved in trying to be involved in or influence government per se. Sorry, you
guys. Well, no, I mean, I just think it's really striking when you mentioned the Moral Majority there getting formed in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And you think about all the promises that were made to evangelical Christians from the 80s through to the present day. If you support us, this is what we'll deliver for you. And in some ways, President Trump was the ultimate example of that transactional relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, you support me, I'll do this for you. And ironically, Trump might have been the president who actually did most for evangelicals, even though he was the least like them. Mm-hmm. You think of the man hours that were put into campaigning on the back of promises that and the money that was given to support candidates. And what actually was achieved as a consequence of all of that, I'm not sure I know. But I mean, I think it's very striking that the Moscow Idaho Christians, you know, whenever they are talking about politics, certainly in the old days until the last year, perhaps, they, like good Reconstructionists, they were very critical of any attempt to change America from the top down. And they were very clear that the moral majority was wrong to try to foist their man, and it was always a man, into the White House in order to change America from the top down. And they were very clear that actually America will only be changed, Rush Dooney said this, and it's been said by many theonomists since, America will only be changed as individuals are converted, as their families are impacted, their neighbourhoods, their towns, their states, their counties, their states, and ultimately the federal government itself.
You mentioned in the book, Rod Dreher's book, The Benedict Option, that came out a couple years ago and was very popular among evangelicals, where he was basically, I guess, talking about how Christians can persist and continue to live in meaningful Christian communities and live meaningful Christian lives, but in a way in which they're, you know, withdrawn to some degree from the world. And he used the Benedictine monastic movement as an example of that. I didn't realize till I read your book that originally he had planned to have a section in his book talking about Doug Wilson. Is that right?
He did. No, he writes about this. He put several entries up about this when he was writing his book Benedict Option up on his blog in the American Conservative website. Yeah, that's right. He was going to write a chapter about the Moscow situation, but abandoned that as a consequence of a case, a discipline case, how would you put it? I'm not sure exactly the details, but...
Pastoral controversy they had.
Exactly,
In Moscow, and he didn't want to include them in the book because of that, right?
He was disappointed by the way they'd handled this case. And so he thought it wasn't a community he wanted to draw attention to. I feel that's a pity, because I think Rod Dreher's book lacks something when it covers communities from across Christendom, let's say, without including anything that could be described broadly speaking as evangelical or reformed, or indeed Protestant. I think, you know, as a Protestant, I feel that's a gap. So, you know, he could have written a chapter on Moscow, and actually it would have benefited his book in several ways. First of all, it would have been by far the largest community that he would have discussed.
Hmm.
It would have been by far the most successful community that he had discussed. And it would have been by far the most influential community that he discussed.
Hmm.
So I do think, I mean, Rod Dreher's book is really interesting, but I think he missed a major opportunity in not talking about that group.
Hmm.
I understand the sensitivities to the pastoral situation, that very sad pastoral situation that was involved there, but I do think he missed something.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Gribben, thank you so much for your insights on this book. And I do think it is a fascinating read. It's very timely. I mean, you're not only describing, I mean, your book covers a lot of ground. I mean, you talk about within the book sort of the history of evangelicalism. You talk about the development of evangelical fiction. You talk about the history of the Reconstruction movement in Reformed theology. And then you're talking about the contemporary experience of Doug Wilson and his influence in the Pacific Northwest. You don't talk about some of the theological controversy Doug Wilson's been involved with, like, you know, federal vision and things like that.
Yeah.
But you're more talking about him as someone who's having influence through his church, his publishing, and higher education, starting a college, and the things he's doing there. But I think you do a good job in this book of talking about, you know, this moment in American history with what's happening and how some evangelicals are responding, to use the title of your book, wanting Christianity to survive, but then also to resist maybe the secularization of the country. I'm curious, though. I mean, you're living in a place where maybe you're some years ahead of where things are in the U.S. Maybe the U.K. is already entered into a more post-Christian type of environment. What do you think we have to learn from maybe other places in Europe, in Western Europe, that are further along the trail into a more post-Christian or secularized society?
That's a great question, Jeff. I would simply think of that verse, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help." I'm not sure what else I could add to that. But I think that obviously our cultures are all changing quite fast. I think we need to know where our resources can be found, and always to remember that the Apostles' Creed is not a political agenda, if you know what I mean. That's a lame response. I don't know, Jeff, but I do think a lot about that verse, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help." If you choose the wrong ally in your culture, you're gonna realize that pretty quickly, I think.
So, aside from you've completed this book, and what else are you working on right now? And then, if you would, let us know, how can people best follow your work?
Thanks, Jeff. Well, I've got a book coming out in the summer, completely different, called "The Rise and Fall of Christian Ireland." So if anyone out there, because there's everybody in America is Irish, as far as I can work out. So if anybody in America is interested in Ireland, either in finding out more about St. Patrick or the medieval monks or the Reformation or why it failed or the revivals or whatever, you can take a look at that book. It'll be out, all being well, in August, "The Rise and Fall of Christian Ireland." And then...
Is that from Oxford University Press also?
It is. Yeah, it is. So I think it'll be about maybe $25, somewhere in that region, to buy. So hopefully out in time for Christmas. And then the project I'm working on at the moment is a project about a very, very obscure, but actually very influential Irish Christian called John Nelson Darby, who was the person who developed what we now know as dispensationalism. Although, interestingly, that's not a word he ever used.
Who coined the phrase dispensationalism then?
Well, I'm trying to find that out, Jeff. So if you know the answer, that would be great. The earliest example I can find of its use is in an anti-Darby book published by a guy called Philip Mowrow in 1875. So I suspect that, a bit like the word Puritan, dispensational is a term that's coined by those who are critics of the movement, but it's a term that's eventually picked up by members of the movement without necessarily realizing how much they changed Darby's teaching by giving it a name. That's maybe.
So is the book you're doing on John Nelson Darby, is it like a biography, or are you taking one aspect of his thinking and looking at it, or what is it?
No, I'm going to, well, it'll probably have some biographical elements just because I'm interested in his life. But what I want to do, Jeff, is to demonstrate that Darby was a Calvinist. So I want to talk about soteriology and the way that he basically inherits a standard Calvinistic soteriology and adapts it slightly, but it's pretty consistently sound. Darby famously walked off a platform with D.L. Moody because D.L. Moody was preaching about free will and Darby hated the notion of free will. I mean, he actually sounds a bit like a hyper-Calvinist. He speaks in some of his letters about outbreaks of free will as if it's a kind of a pandemic, you know, a contagious pandemic. So it'll be a chapter in that, a chapter on the role of the Holy Spirit in his theology, chapter on the church, as the body of Christ that's composed by the Holy Spirit. And then a chapter in his eschatology. So I want to demonstrate that this will be really controversial, but I want to demonstrate that Darby is much, much more reformed than either dispensationalists or reformed Christians give him credit for. And I want to remind everyone that he was a lifelong pedo-Baptist, and also that he was much less of a dispensationalist than people think. Modern dispensationalism is really developed by the Scofield Reference Bible, which is quite different from Darby's view of dispensationalism, sometimes in very significant ways. Wow. So Darby himself is a fascinating character. If you think John Owen's hard to read, you want to start reading J.N. Darby.
It seems like there ought to be color-coded graphs that will come alongside of whatever
graphs. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We will look forward to seeing those things coming out on the horizon, and appreciate your labors in this book and the other things that you've written. And you know, there's certain special people who are called out to do the kind of tasks that you're doing, to dig deep and study history. And so, thank you for your labors. This is going to bring this episode of Word Magazine to a conclusion. I hope that you have enjoyed and profited from this discussion and interview. And I will look forward to speaking to you in the next Word Magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.